Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Peter Kornbluh, senior analyst with the National Security Archive, who looks at the life and death of Chilean dictator Augusto Pinochet. Writer and activist Frank Morales, who explains how new federal legislation makes it easier for American presidents to declare martial law. And Richard Dieter, executive director of the Death Penalty Information Center, who assesses the significance of orders from Florida and California's governors to temporarily halt executions by lethal injection. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In the midst of the Israeli incursion into Lebanon in July, Israeli fighter jets bombed a power plant south of Beirut that created a massive oil leak of 10,000 to 15,000 tons of crude oil. The oil leak soon became Lebanon's worst environmental disaster, threatening coastal waters in Lebanon, Syria, Cyprus, Greece, and Turkey. 4 months after the conflict between Israeli and Hezbollah fighters ended, marine birds remain under threat. A key area of concern is the internationally protected Palm Islands Nature Reserve near Tripoli, particularly now that the migratory season has begun. According to the Interpress service, cleanup of sunken crude oil only began in mid-October as teams of divers from Italy started underwater recovery efforts near Jiyed, the power plant, located 30 kilometers from the Lebanese capital. During the summer, a team from Lebanon's Environment Ministry and the World Conservation Union discovered coastal rocks, caves, and beaches covered with oil. The shores act as the habitat for the rare loggerhead turtle and monk seal. Now, the Lebanese government estimates it could take as much as $100 million to clean up the oil spill. Rick Steiner, oil expert and member of the Conservation Union, fears that oil-exposed hatchlings may die or suffer other non-lethal effects, including carcinogenesis, physiological and reproductive impairment. As French oil expert Xavier Kremer observed, people who live off the sea will remember this all of their lives. It will stain their memory forever. The Bushmen of Botswana have won the right to return to their ancestral land in the Central Kalahari Game Reserve in southern Africa. The Bushmen, also known as the San people, were forced out of the game reserve during a campaign by the government starting in the late 1990s. The Botswana government cut off the water supply and prohibited hunting by the native tribe. Most of the Bushmen were forced to live in settlement communities like New Shade, plagued by violence and alcoholism. According to Reuters, Botswana's high court ruled 2-1 in favor of the Bushmen, who won the backing of Western indigenous rights activists and South African Anglican bishop Desmond Tutu. Writing for the majority, Justice Mpafi Fumafi stated, "The simultaneous stoppage of the supply of food rations and stoppage of hunting licenses is tantamount to condemning the remaining residents of the Central Kalahari Game Reserve to starvation." Gordon Bennett, a lawyer for the Bushmen, says the decision allows the Bushmen to return to the land their ancestors have lived in for 20,000 years. Roy Sisana of the pressure group First People of Kalahari declared, "We have been crying for so long, but today we are crying with happiness." Over the last year, the Starbucks Cafe Empire and the Ethiopian government have fought over trademark rights to brands of premium coffee beans such as Sidamo and Harar. The rights to the coffee brand names could be worth as much as $90 million to poor Ethiopian coffee farmers. Fair trade groups have launched a campaign against Starbucks to get the $6.4 billion coffee giant to honor the Ethiopian trademarks, now recognized in 30 countries. As Oxfam fair trade campaigner Seth Petchers told OneWorld.net, "It's important to understand that most Ethiopians live on less than a dollar a day. Starbucks sells some of these beans for up to $26 a pound." Coffee exports account for 60% of Ethiopia's foreign currency exchange and 10% of all government revenue. Moreover, 1.2 million small farmers in the East African nation make a living by picking coffee. As Oxfam's Petchers added, small-scale coffee farmers are economically vulnerable, in part because foreign buyers such as Starbucks are dictating with their extraordinary market power. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
The death of Chilean General Augusto Pinochet on December 10th ended any further attempts to bring to justice one of Latin America's most brutal dictators. The Chilean military, led by General Pinochet, staged a bloody coup against the democratically elected socialist government of Salvador Allende in 1973. In the years which followed, Pinochet's regime killed nearly 3,200 suspected political opponents, tortured 28,000, and disappeared more than 1,000. During Pinochet's reign of terror, which ended in 1990, hundreds of thousands of Chileans fled their nation to seek refuge around the world. Official U.S. government documents confirm that President Richard Nixon was complicit in supporting and planning the Chilean coup. In 1976, Pinochet's secret police ordered the car bomb assassination of former Chilean ambassador to the U.S., Orlando Letelier, and his associate Ronnie Moffitt in downtown Washington, D.C. From October 1998 to March 2001, Pinochet was placed under house arrest in London while he awaited Britain's decision on a Spanish request to extradite the general to stand trial on murder and torture charges. Eventually, British authorities released Pinochet to return to Chile after determining that the aging despot was neither physically or mentally fit to stand trial. Pinochet was later discovered to have stolen some $27 million and concealing the money in U.S. and other overseas banks. At the time of his death, Pinochet was under investigation in multiple human rights cases and under house arrest in Chile. Although he was never brought to trial, the dictator lived to see one of his torture victims, socialist Michelle Bachelet, elected Chile's president. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Peter Kornbluh, senior analyst with the National Security Archive and author of the book The Pinochet File, a declassified dossier on atrocity and accountability. Kornbluh looks at the legacy of Augusto Pinochet and continuing demands for the release of U.S. documents related to the dictator's brutal repression.
The declassified documents that we were able to press the Clinton administration to release about 6 years ago showed overwhelmingly that Henry Kissinger was the primary mover and shaker in pushing the Nixon administration to take a very hard line against Allende and to trying to stabilize his government. And then Kissinger was the primary architect and primary promoter of supporting the Pinochet regime, despite multiple reports that reached Kissinger's desk of his ongoing atrocities. It really is a very damning declassified history of one man's very powerful effort to undermine democracy in Chile and support dictatorship there. And it's a case study in the exercise of power and gross complicity and gross insensitivity and rejection of human rights as a criteria in U.S. foreign policy. But it was because of Kissinger's embrace of Pinochet and his kind of going the extra mile to provide economic and military support to Pinochet, even in the face of very highly publicized atrocities that were going on in Chile, that the U.S. Congress, pressed by the American public, some of them the very listeners that you have on your show, decided to pass the first laws mandating that human rights be a criteria for U.S. economic aid to the Third World, for U.S. Military aid to other governments, for U.S. votes in multilateral banks, for loans to other governments. And so we had the institutionalization of a human rights criteria in U.S. foreign policy because of the kind of Kissinger-Pinochet relationship in the mid-1970s.
Peter, you've worked very hard on trying to investigate Chile and possible U.S. involvement in the assassination of Chilean dissident Orlando Letelier and his U.S. assistant, Ronnie Moffitt, in Washington, D.C. Tell us a little bit about that case and the efforts that are currently underway to try and declassify more documents so that Chile and the U.S. and the rest of the world can know the truth about the circumstances surrounding that assassination.
Orlando Letelier was a former Allende ambassador to Washington. He was Secretary of Defense on the day of the coup. Augusto Pinochet was actually an aide to him. He was the leading opponent of the Pinochet regime, probably in the whole world. He was the most effective critic of the regime, the one who had the most influence and respect and credibility as he tried to press governments, including the U.S. government, to take a strong stand in support of the return of Chilean democracy. Pinochet sent his secret police agents to Washington in September of 1976 They placed a bomb under Letelier's car on September 19th, and then a team of anti-Castro Cubans who were collaborating with the Chilean secret police followed the car on September 21st, 1976. With Orlando Letelier were two of his colleagues, his assistant Michael Moffitt and his colleague Ronnie Moffitt in the car. And the bomb went off, and Ronnie was killed, and Orlando was killed, and Michael survived this atrocity. This was the most egregious act of international terrorism in our nation's capital up until the plane sent by Osama bin Laden went into the Pentagon on 9/11/2001, and it remains, you know, an extraordinary atrocity in the history of the United States. When Pinochet was arrested in London in October of 1998, the Letelier and Moffitt families went to the Clinton White House. I went to some meetings myself to try and press them, one, to declassify all the documents on Pinochet's involvement in the Letelier assassination and his involvement in all human rights atrocities and terrorism, but as well to press the Clinton administration to prosecute Pinochet. If Spain was going to try and prosecute him for crimes against humanity, why shouldn't the United States prosecute him for sending a team of assassins to our nation's capital to commit this act of terrorism? And the Clinton administration, to its credit, did decide to release a lot of documents, but also to reopen an investigation into Pinochet's role. All the documents that related to Pinochet's role in the Letelier assassination were withheld from release while this investigation went on. The Bush administration inherited this investigation even as they began a major war on terrorism and had the opportunity to make Pinochet a symbol of President Bush's argument that no nation should sit back and let terrorists go free, that all nations should be prosecuting terrorism and there's terrorists, and that there's no statute of limitation on acts of international terror. The Bush administration really has kind of shelved this investigation, I think, or really not taking it seriously with any urgency. The documents were withheld, and there was no indictment in the end. And now the opportunity to indict Pinochet as the intellectual author of this atrocity in Washington has come and gone. However, we still have the possibility of the indictment of history, and so we are now trying to get all of the documents out, all the documents declassified, so at least we will have the historical record on Pinochet's role in this international crime. Not only do the families of Orlando Letelier and Ronnie Moffitt deserve this, but the American public deserves to know the full story of how the United States government managed to fail in detecting and deterring a mission to commit international terrorism in our nation's capital.
That was Peter Kornbluh, senior analyst with the National Security Archive and author of The Pinochet File. Visit the National Security Archive website to read related documents at www.nsarchive.org. In a legislative maneuver that largely slipped below the media radar screen, Congress passed and President Bush signed into law in mid-October a measure that will make it easier for American presidents to declare federal martial law. Congress revised the Insurrection Act, bypassing existing prohibitions there and within the Posse Comitatus Act that had prevented the president from deploying U.S. military troops within the nation's borders. The Defense Authorization Act of 2007, signed into law by Mr. Bush in a private White House ceremony, empowers the president to declare a public emergency, station troops anywhere in America, and take control of state-based National Guard units without the consent of the governor or local authorities in order to suppress public disorder. U.S. Senator Patrick Leahy of Vermont warned that the implications of changing the Posse Comitatus Act are enormous. There is good reason, he said, for the constructive friction in existing law when it comes to martial law declarations. Using the military for law enforcement goes against one of the founding tenets of our democracy. The new law authorizes police to detain and imprison, quote, illegal aliens, potential terrorists, protesters, and other undesirables. Ominously, in January, Congress awarded $385 million to Kellogg Brown and Root, a subsidiary of Halliburton, for the construction of temporary detention and processing facilities in the event of an emergency influx of immigrants into the U.S. Frank Morales, an Episcopalian priest at St. Mark's Church in New York City, is a writer and activist. His article, titled Bush Moves Toward Martial Law, is one of the few news stories on these new presidential powers. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Morales about the potential consequences for civil liberties stemming from this change in federal law.
The 2007 Defense Authorization Act was signed the same day as the Military Commissions Act. But what the public was not aware of is that the very same day, in a much smaller ceremony, Bush signed this Defense Authorization Act, which is an annual appropriation to the Pentagon totaling somewhere in the neighborhood of $500 billion. Within that bill, within that law, because it's now law, their Section 1076 rewrites the Insurrection Act and allows for the executive to station troops anywhere within the United States outside of the okay, the acquiescence of the local governors. When this was in bill form, the Governors Association unanimously voted in opposition to this bill, to this provision, and made its point known. So did various sectors of the military, who also have taken a position that further incursions into domestic law enforcement was a contradiction to their mission. And in fact, you know, represented, if not specific violation of law, at least the intent of the law, the Posse Comitatus Act, an 1878 statute which bars the military from enforcing laws domestically. So as a result of this legislation, Patrick Leahy from Vermont, right up until the point of its passage, issued a number of statements which were not covered in the mainstream press, nor was the fact of this signing covered in the mainstream press. He states very clearly that this legislation allows for the president to move more smoothly into martial law situations. He makes it very clear that he's quite afraid that what we're looking at here is the potential for a very grave situation vis-a-vis, you know, the civil liberties of people, the fact that we fought a revolution to maintain a strict distinction between the military function and the police function, the whole idea of stationing and quartering troops in homes and so on. In other words, the American tradition of separation between the military and the police is one of the bedrock kind of foundational elements of our democracy. And in one swipe of the pen, Bush has obliterated the intent of the Posse Comitatus Act, which keeps that line very clear between the military and the police function.
Frank, you write ominously about the awarding of contracts by the U.S. government to Kellogg, Brunn, and Root, a division of Halliburton, to erect detention facilities. I think they've got some $385 million over 5 years to construct these detention facilities. How is that linked with this move toward martial law and getting rid of the Posse Comitatus Act?
It may be overly simplified to suggest that these detention camps are there precisely to deal with the reaction, the growing reaction to the Bush agenda. And I use that term generally because this agenda apparently is shared by most of the people in Congress, regardless of what party affiliation they come from. These camps, they're real. I mean, they're in the process of being constructed, and they've been charged to construct these detention facilities in the event of a so-called immigration emergency, similar to Rex 84 plans back in 1984, the Reagan era, when similar kinds of detention facilities were being discussed. This is a lot harder in terms of the information available, and I think that what we're looking at is the potential for the kinds of camps in which people who have done nothing more than exercise their right of free speech and free assembly are essentially rounded up and put into these detention facilities. You know, it may sound far-fetched, and I believe that they're whistling in the dark because I don't think the American people would ever stand for it. I don't think that the military or the police, for that matter, from what I've been picking up, will go for it.
And although, as you said, it sounds far-fetched now that there would be detention camps erected for dissidents, if you look at a scenario of another terrorist attack in this country, mm-hmm. just as the Bush administration used that terrorist attack for cover,
yeah.
for their long-standing plan to invade Iraq,
exactly.
they similarly could in the future use another terrorist attack in this country as cover to round up any kind of dissident. And a lot of people will salute that flag just because there's a lot of fear in the country after a serious terrorist attack. And, you know, before you know it, you've lost all your liberties. Out of fear, you went along.
We need to just stay active, stay aware, and keep our ear to the ground and understand what we're up against here. Remember, a police state is only effective to the extent that it is able to carry out its agenda on the ground, whether it's local people or people that are brought in and so on, but they look just like you and me. We can impact on that if we move preemptively and keep, you know, focus, keep delineate the evil so that we can't change what we don't see.
That was Frank Morales, Episcopalian priest, activist, and writer. Read his article titled Bush Moves Toward Martial Law online at www.towardfreedom.com. On December 15th, the Republican governors of California and Florida, Arnold Schwarzenegger and Jeb Bush, respectively, both temporarily halted executions in their states and have called for investigations into the use of lethal injection. That is the method of execution used in those two states and 35 others. Bush took action after a botched execution in which it appears that convicted murderer Angel Diaz was likely conscious and in excruciating pain for the 34 minutes it took him to die, after a second dose of toxic chemicals had to be injected. California has the highest number of death row inmates in the country at around 650. It has executed just 13 people since stricter death penalty laws were ratified and declared constitutional in 1977, overturning a ban earlier in the decade based on violations of the Eighth Amendment, prohibiting cruel and unusual punishment. Florida has executed 64 people in the past 29 years. Texas has executed 379 inmates, which is why its death row population has fallen behind other states. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Richard Dieter, executive director of the Death Penalty Information Center, an advocacy organization that opposes the death penalty. He assesses the importance of the December 15th governor's orders and explains why support in the U.S. for the death penalty is dropping.
I think it should be first noted that these are the two states with the largest death rows in the country, California and Florida. And for both of them on the same day to announce that executions for the foreseeable future on hold is an amazing event, and I think is symbolic of change going on around the death penalty in many states, with the lethal injection issue being one of the most current issues being debated on this.
People talk about botched executions, but what precisely do you think led to these two decisions? It seems to be in the context of dwindling support for the death penalty in the U.S.
Well, they're actually the same problem in both states, and that is that you have a medical procedure is what is used for killing people, for executions in this country now. It's a process that was derived from the operating rooms, and the chemicals were used in operations. But they're performed by guards, by people who are not trained in the medical profession. So mistakes happen or are bound to happen. In Florida, they did happen. And so they have stopped executions. They're going to investigate what went wrong. But it was almost inevitable that this would occur. In California, they stopped them before, or at least before more problems occurred, and are trying to find a way out, trying to find, who should oversee these so the mistakes aren't made? Can doctors be involved, or are they ethically bound not to? So there's some sticky problems ahead, but the basic issue is similar in both states.
Isn't it true that doctors don't participate because to do so would be a violation of the Hippocratic concept of first do no harm?
Yes, that's true. And the American Medical Association, the American Association of Anesthesiologists, veterinarians, EMTs, they're all, across the board saying that they would not participate in these executions. They sometimes can confirm that death has occurred. But I think a system that relies on the doctors always being there is going to have, problems. There are a few doctors who, despite this ethical prohibition, still participate, but by and large, doctors do not and are not willing to.
Richard Dieter, when I think about ways to die, to be executed, I personally always thought the firing squad would be the way to go. the least painful and the quickest. Was lethal injection really developed as a more humane method of execution?
It was, although I think when we say humane, what people are really after is a way that appears humane, that is easier for the guards, for the witnesses, for everyone responsible. That includes, you know, juries and judges. We do not want to see a fiery execution such as occurred when electrocutions malfunctioned or hangings where the people were sometimes beheaded. You know, we're not going back there. It turns out that lethal injection was thought to be an advance on all of that, but it has its own problems, at least as it's being administered today. Science has advanced, and it now appears that some of these inmates are conscious when they're injected with a heart attack drug, a heart-stopping drug, which is extremely painful. So that has to be changed in some way if executions are going to continue with lethal injection. Frankly, I don't see what other method is out there for them to go to other than lethal injection.
Polls show that support for the death penalty is trending down, and I know that's partly due to the number of exonerations of death row inmates that have occurred in recent years. And this concern about lethal injection being cruel and unusual punishment is probably contributing to that loss of support as well.
The support for the death penalty has decreased. In 1994, the Gallup poll asked whether people supported the death penalty, and 80% said they did. This year, they asked the same question. Only 65% said they did, which is still, of course, a majority. But they also asked people, which would you think is the proper punishment for murder, death penalty or life without parole? And for the first time this year, more people said life without parole. They've been asking that question for 20 years. So things are changing. There's still support for the death penalty, but people are willing to substitute alternatives, and they support it less. And there's good reasons for that. There is skepticism in the public about whether the government can do this program right, can decide who should live and who should die and do it in a way that's acceptable to the American public. So, there's larger issues about fairness and innocence. And now the lethal injection, I think, adds on to that burden in a way that the death penalty presents.
That was Richard Dieter of the Death Penalty Information Center. Contact the center by calling area code 202-289-2275 or visit their website at www.deathpenaltyinfo.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.